Welcome back to our class, Encounters with Jesus. These are episodes from the Gospel of Mark that help us to gain insight into Jesus' ministry. And this week we're looking at a woman who had persistent faith. And so after Jesus encounters the unsympathetic Pharisees, he briefly steps away from Herod's jurisdiction, away from the fury of the religious leaders, and he retreats with his disciples to Gentile country. There he meets this woman of great faith. Her faith deliberately contrasts with the unbelief of the religious leaders as well as the dull-hearted disciples. And our passage is from Mark chapter 7, verses 24 to 30. And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And he entered a house and did not want anyone to know. Yet he could not be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." And he said to her, "For this statement you may go your way, the demon has left your daughter." And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. There was a Greek poet, Archilochus, who wrote this: The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. So the fox is cunning and sly, has numerous tricks up his sleeve, you could say, but the hedgehog operates on one central organizing principle. You crawl up into a ball and you become invincible. Well, the woman in this story probably doesn't know very much about Jesus, maybe doesn't have a lot of sophisticated knowledge about Jesus, probably could not explain to you the nuances of eschatology or Christology or soteriology or parse the differences between infra and supralapsarianism, but her faith is driven by one central organizing principle, and that is this, that Jesus can help me with my most significant problem. And she doggedly clings to this truth with a determined faith. And her story contrasts with the knowledgeable Pharisees who are experts in the law, but did not know or love or trust Jesus, and their hearts have been hardened by unbelief. And she also contrasts with the disciples who are slow to understand and dull of mind and heart. And Jesus welcomed this woman's faith. It was such a rarity, so refreshing to him. Spurgeon says, "Our Lord had a very quick eye for spying faith, and he watched it and delighted in it, and he resolved to turn it around and set it in other lights so that the various facets of this priceless diamond might each one flash its brilliance and delight his soul." So you can almost see this in the interaction with Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman, this Gentile woman holding up her faith for everyone to see. Everyone who will come along and read Mark's gospel can see and hear about her faith. So we wanted to look at three things about this woman's life, her plight, her persistence, and then Jesus' power, the way that Jesus answers her requests. So first of all, her plight. We're told in verse 24 that Jesus went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. So this is him retreating, moving away from the action, moving away from the pressures of ministry. So for the second time in Mark's gospel, Jesus is now venturing into Gentile territory. The first time was back in chapter 5 when he encountered the Gerasene demoniac. So this is just a short trip, maybe 20 miles away from Galilee. This is in the coastal district on the Mediterranean coast, what would be modern-day Lebanon. We could say Jesus is going to the beach. Jesus is going to the coast for a few days. Maybe he's trying to escape the escalating pressure from Herod, or the escalating tension with the religious leaders. They're pestering him, they're after him. Or it may just be that he needs a break and a little rest away from the constant pressure of the crowds. Well, Matthew Henry draws attention here to the humility of Christ's ministry. Jesus goes to great efforts to conceal himself. He does not give himself the rock star treatment, entering town with big fanfare. It says in verse 24, he did not want anyone to know that he was there. So his popularity is surging in Galilee. They're ready to make him king. There's no shortage of applause. He can just hang around and enjoy the adulation of his fans. But he does not do that. He retreats here to a private house, not the synagogue, not the local sports arena where he can gather crowds and speak to them, but a private retreat for the restoration of body and soul. So here he is seeking anonymity. He doesn't want anybody to know he's there, traveling incognito. But Jesus could no more remain hidden, says Matthew Henry, than the sun could stop shining. His fame goes before him, even into Gentile territory. So he's approached by this woman, a woman with desperate circumstances. How often have we seen this replayed in the Gospels, especially the Gospel of Mark? Someone who desperately needs help knows that Jesus can help. Verse 25, immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. So like the Gerizim demoniac back in chapter 5, verse 6, or Jairus, the ruler of the synagogue in chapter 5, verse 22, or the unclean woman in chapter 5, verse 33, this woman falls at the feet of Jesus and pleads for help. Now right away she has two strikes against her, part of her plight. She is a woman, like the unclean woman in Mark 5. This woman is treated like she would have been treated like a second-class citizen by her culture. Whereas Christianity has always given equal status to women as co-image bearers of God, created by God, and co-heirs of the grace of life and redemption. So she has a strike against her. She's a woman. She's not a Jew. There's another strike against her. She's an outsider. She's ethnically different. She's not a child of Abraham. She's a Gentile. So she would be alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, as Ephesians 2:12 tells us, a stranger to the covenants of promise. And Mark tells us that she came and fell down at his feet, that she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. Didn't beg just once, didn't ask just once, but repeatedly kept on asking. Well, made a pest of herself. She would not be denied. Matthew also has an account of this story, and we're told in Matthew's parallel account that she persistently and noisily kept crying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon." That's Matthew 15:22. And your heart breaks for her if you read this story with any kind of tenderness. Her daughter is in bondage, tormented by this demonic spirit. And so her plight causes her to cry out to Jesus for help. She's like that hedgehog that Archilochus mentions. He knows one thing, one big thing. I know that Jesus can solve the biggest problems in my life. So I need to get to him. I need to ask him for his help. So from her plight, then we move to her persistence. And this is where the story takes an odd turn, maybe an unusual turn. This is the heart of the story. When Jesus, again, holds this woman's faith up to the light, like a diamond, and just allows it to shine, and with its luster. Look at verse 27 of Mark 7. He said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Now, at first, we're taken back by Jesus' response. Jesus sounds rude, doesn't he? Doesn't he sound a little bit impertinent, maybe? Unkind? His response is even offensive. He calls this woman a dog. Is that what he's really doing? This does not seem to fit at all with the tender, loving care that we see Jesus exercising in so many other stories in the Gospels, who comes to rescue the poor, to heal the blind, to heal the deaf and the lame, and free them from their oppression and misery. Didn't he read Miss Manners? Didn't he read the Modern Guide to Southern Etiquette? That if you value your life, never, ever call a woman a dog. It's a terrible insult. Elsewhere in the New Testament, heretics and false teachers are called dogs. In Revelation 22:15, for example, Matthew's account adds another layer of intrigue, because before he had issued this, what sounds to us a rude statement, he didn't even speak to her at all. Matthew 15:23, he did not answer her a word. So he's silent, and then he issues this very, what seems to be a hurtful statement, communicating indifference. That's what silent communicates. We say that the opposite of love is not hatred, but indifference. Indifference says, I don't care what happens to you. Would any of us ignore someone who is pleading at our feet for the life of their daughter? Not a one of us, unless we are just very cold and callous and cruel. I traveled to a third world country several years ago, and if you've been to an underdeveloped nation, you know that the beggars are everywhere. And I was on a ferry traveling up a river to our destination, and was exhausted from the long journey, and I stepped out of our vehicle to stretch my legs there on the ferry, and silently, almost zombie-like, the beggars appeared out of nowhere. They had made their way onto this ferry. And They stood there with open hands. And how do you turn away from that? How do you look away from that? I've been strongly encouraged and told, do not give anything out, because you'll bring an even greater horde of beggars to yourself, like a flock of seagulls at the beach. And that it felt so awkward, so cold, so indifferent to avoid looking these people in the eye. But that's what I've been told to do for my own safety. Was Jesus, the Good Shepherd, coldly ignoring this woman's plight? Actually, Jesus was not being indifferent. Kent Hughes labels Jesus' silence here as the silence of love. He was elevating this woman's awareness of her own faith, holding it up again like the diamond, like Spurgeon says, like the diamond, not only to her, but also to the church, to all of us who would read this story after, as if to say to the rest of us, do you see this faith? Wow. And her silence, his silence then, is followed by the shocking statement in verse 27, let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Now who would the children be? The children would be the Jewish people, the Israelites. They get first priority in redemptive history. Now, Romans 1 says the gospel came to the Jew first. Acts 1:8. Jesus issues his great commission. He says, take the gospel to Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth. It's the Jewish people who are given first priority. The children eat first. It wasn't that the dogs get nothing. They were fed after the children. What Jesus is foreshadowing here is the coming expansion of the kingdom of God to include both Jew and Gentile. The Gentiles here are the dogs in verse 27. They're the outsiders. They're excluded, scorned, contemptible. You know, we love dogs, we love Fido, and we love to have pets at home, and whereas in the ancient world dogs were not prized, contrary to our modern affinity for canines, the biblical image of a dog's life is one of squalor and dismal poverty, and the life of a pariah at the bottom of the social scale. You call someone a dog, you're basically saying they're a social pariah, like these dogs, street urchins. Vile, vicious, unclean scavengers, not the domesticated pets that crawl up into your lap and lick your face and you get to rub their belly. These were outcasts that elicited repulsion. And that's how the Jewish people view the Gentiles, as dogs. But Jesus calls her a dog, but he switches up the metaphor just a little bit. He uses the diminutive form of the word dog rather than the more common street urchin dog. He's softening it a little. And referring to her to more like a house dog or a lap dog. Now, but he's still calling her a dog, and so that still sounds insulting to us, doesn't it? Well, Jesus is not being hateful. He's using directness, candor, because this is the reality, that in the overall plan of redemptive history, the Gentiles have a subordinate status at this point. Now, Jesus loves this woman. He's charmed by her faith. He's blessed by her faith. And sometimes when the master sees great faith, he will test it in order to mature it, to make it blossom. And Jesus intentionally provokes this woman to draw out this persistent faith in the context of her plight. And her rebuttal is very swift. She says, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. Her faith is determined. It's persistent. Jesus makes it difficult for this woman, but she will not be put off, like Jacob in Genesis 32, ready to wrestle with God, laying hold of God, saying, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Like the hedgehog, she returns to the one central organizing principle, Jesus can help me with my most significant problems. She will not let him go until he blesses her. And here this nameless woman's eyes have been opened. She gets it. She gets her own identity. She is a dog, and in terms of Jesus' identity, and yet her response, you know, she agrees with the label that Jesus gives to her, and her response is one of respect. It's profound. She addresses Jesus as Lord. The term of respect is the only place that's used here in Mark's gospel. So she responds with respect and humility. Now, she could have thrown a tantrum. Imagine me walking up to someone on the sidewalk who's asking of me a very very earnest favor, and I call that person a dog, I should expect for the local news to be called out on me. I should expect for CNN to run footage of that later in the evening. But that's not what this woman does. She doesn't throw a tantrum. She doesn't call for a press conference to declare how oppressed she has been by this chauvinistic Messiah. How dare Jesus call her a dog? No, that's not how she responds. She's not offended, but rather she accepts the designation of dog. Yes, Lord, I'm a dog. But even the dogs get the crumbs that the children drop. And I can claim the crumbs now. Salvation is available to all who humbly respond in faith. Could we say that Jesus is bested by this woman rhetorically? She throws Jesus' statement back in his face. She goes right up to the edge, just like Jesus goes right up to the edge. Jesus is usually the one who wins the debates quite soundly. He puts the religious leaders in their place time after time. He confounds his opponents at every turn. But here, he seems to concede that his opponent is right, that he is wrong, in the sense that he is, again, wanting to draw out her faith. I mean, Jesus is not wrong, I understand that, but in the sense that he is drawing out her faith and allowing it to shine in all of its luster. Martin Luther says she catches Christ with his own words. Yes, Lord, you are correct. I am a little dog, but that means I get some of the children's crumbs. Persistent, determined faith. Notice that the traditional elements of faith are present here. Knowledge, assent, and trust. Knowledge, she knows that Jesus can help her. In fact, in Matthew's account, she actually says, Lord, help me. That's Matthew 15:25. Assent, she agrees that he's the source of the crumbs, that he alone can provide healing and salvation. There is salvation in no one else. Knowledge, assent. And then there's trust. There's a gutsiness and unflappableness to this faith. She is a living embodiment of what we sing. Nothing in my hands I bring, simply to thy cross I cling. So her plight, her persistence. And then finally we see his power. His power. Jesus heals this woman's daughter on the spot. Verse 29, he said to her, for this statement you may go your way, the demon has left your daughter. And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. Now, it would be irresponsible for us to say at this point that this woman's persistence earned Christ's favor, earned his healing power. We're not saying that at all. Nothing could be further from the truth. But her persistence was a demonstration of genuine faith. Genuine faith persists. Genuine faith manifested itself here in this plucky courage and determination. Yes, she knew she was a dog. She knew her inferior status to the Jews, the Israelites. She knew that she did not merit Christ's help. She had nothing to commend her to Christ. She was a Gentile, an outsider, a stranger to the covenants, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel. But the bottom line is this, that she depended upon Christ's goodness and power and not her own. And it was all of grace. David understood this in Psalm 51 when he says, the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, you will not despise. Christ promoted this too in the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And in Matthew's account, Jesus refers to this Syrophoenician woman, refers to her great faith. Great faith is possible. Great faith is great because it lays hold of a great Christ, a powerful Christ. Even weak faith lays hold of a strong Christ. And she took Jesus at his word. Lord, if you say that I'm a little dog, that's what I am. But it means that I have a master, and that master is you. And it means that I'm a humble part of the household. I'm in the house, and I can claim the crumbs. This was faith that believed his word. Faith that persisted.